Mark was just saying about opening our understanding as well. And that is very relevant. I'm sure you've heard the term, ignorance is bliss. Yeah? Ignorance is bliss. And sort of derivative of that, sort of blissful ignorance. This idea of not knowing any of the unpleasant facts, being unaware or inexperienced of something that's unpleasant. One of the sort of images that comes to my mind when I think about that is when Stephen was very young and we had to put eye drops in him. And I said to him, come over here, Stephen. He came over. I said, just lie down on the settee. He lay down on the settee. I said, open your eye. He opened his eye. I put the first drop in and from there on in, it was a fight. The first time, he didn't know what was coming, so he just did what I said. Yeah, straightforward. Blissful ignorance. Drop two was not a case of any longer being in a state of blissful ignorance. He knew what was coming. It's an ostrich mentality. It's ignoring facts. Now, we're not talking about faith when we say about ignoring facts. There's a big difference between faith that sees facts as they appear, and the ostrich mentality that says there's nothing there. Because faith takes into account all the facts. You know, so often we look at something and we have a certain thing that we see. But faith says there's actually more than that, and we're taking that into account. But this sort of blissful ignorance is a deliberate avoidance of truth. For whatever reason, maybe we've never been that way before. Have you ever heard it said about somebody, they don't let facts get in the way of a good opinion? Yeah? In other words, don't matter about what's true, this is what I think. I've come across people like that, and they can be very difficult to persuade. In fact, virtually unpersuadable, because they have their opinion. And it doesn't matter what facts, what truth you present to them, their opinion is fixed. Sometimes it's a case of, I don't want to believe that. You've told me the truth, you've given me the facts, this is how it stands, but I don't believe it. In other words, I'm refusing to accept it. You know, there was a very sad case that I came across. There was a guy who was in hospital and we'd been told that he'd got terminal cancer. And I popped up one lunchtime because the university is quite close to the Western Park Hospital. I know where it is, even if I don't know its name. I went up to see him because we knew him. And as I spoke to him, I was staggered. I was blown away. He was telling me what was going to happen when he got out of hospital. He told me what would be happening the following year, how he'd got a trip planned. And he was giving me all these details of what was going to happen when he got out of hospital. To such an extent that when I left him, I thought, we've got the wrong story here. This guy is not dying of cancer. I don't know how the facts have got twisted, crossed or whatever, but I've got it wrong. 2 weeks later, he was dead. He had been told that he had terminal cancer. His relatives had passed the news on, but he did not accept the fact that he had terminal cancer. Facts, said President of the United States, John Adams, are stubborn things. And whatever may be our wishes, whatever may be our inclination, whatever is our passion, they cannot alter the state of facts and evidence. Facts are stubborn things. As I say, faith doesn't ignore facts. It takes into account all the facts. Whereas the state of blissful ignorance chooses, either through inexperience or deliberate choice, not to take into account the true facts. Let's illustrate the difference. Daniel 3, 8-18. We have the situation of Meshach, Shadrach and Abednego. The commander had gone out. When the music starts, you bow down to the altar. You worship the image. They were found out not to be doing this, and they were brought before the king. This is what it says in verse 13. Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold that I have set up? Now when you hear the sound of horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, if you are not ready to fall down and worship the image I've made, very good. Sorry, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not deliver us, we still won't bow down." These were men of faith who saw the facts. The facts were, they were in this kingdom, this order had been given, and they chose to disobey it. Now, the ostrich mentality would say, "Ah, well, we've been appointed to fairly high positions in this kingdom. He likes us, so I'm sure if push comes to shove, he won't actually do it, because nobody's been thrown in, so he won't really start with us." That would be the ostrich outlook. The faith outlook says, "Yeah, if you want to, go ahead and do it, but our God can deliver us." And that's the difference. The ostrich says it'll never happen. Faith says if it does happen, we're covered, whatever happens. I'm sure you've heard the very necessary statement, ignorance of the law is no excuse. When you or I, in a situation where we've crossed a line, broken the law or whatever, and we could turn around and say, "I'm sorry, I didn't know," the court would say, ignorance of the law is no excuse. We have a responsibility to know. We need to understand. Francis Bacon said this, "Knowledge is power." Knowledge is power. If you know something, it gives you a certain amount of power. Sometimes people try to restrict that, try to hold it in. I was talking to a guy a few weeks back who was responsible for training others, and he says, "Yeah, they told them that I got to tell them. I got to train them. Tell them what I know." He says, "I did, but I didn't tell them everything." And in doing that, he's keeping his hand on the power. Yeah? There's bits that these new trainees have been given the wherewithal to work and function on these machines. But there were bits that when they came to it, they wouldn't know what to do, so they'd have to go back to him for further instruction. God doesn't want us to be ignorant, or if you translate the word that's used there, agnoeo, literally, he doesn't want us to be unknowing. In Romans 11:25, it says this, Paul writing says, "I do not want you to be ignorant." 1 Corinthians 10:1. Again, he's writing to the Corinthians there, and he says, "I do not want you to be ignorant of the facts, brothers and sisters." In 1 Corinthians 12:1, he says, about the gifts of the Spirit, brothers and sisters, "I do not want you to be ignorant or uninformed. I want you to know." In 1 Thessalonians 4:13, talking about the resurrection, Paul says, "We do not want you to be uninformed or ignorant about the facts of those who have gone to sleep in faith." God does not want his people to be ignorant. God wants his people to know. Jesus said this, "If you hold to my teachings, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Firstly, it implies that the people he were talking to weren't free. They understood that because they said, "We're Abraham's descendants. We've never been slaves of anyone. How can you say that we aren't free?" Jesus replied, "Verily, I tell you, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. Now a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son's place belongs forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be really, truly, completely free." He simply assumed that because they were Abraham's descendants, they were free. They were in a state of ignorance. How blissful was it? Well, however blissful it was, Jesus shocked them out of it. What I'd like to do over the next few Sunday mornings when I'm bringing the message is to follow on this theme of things that we need to know. So what do we need to know? The first thing is this, Luke 14:25-35. It says, "Large crowds were travelling with Jesus. He turned to them and said, 'If anyone comes to me and does not hate father, mother, wife, children, brothers and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be my disciple.' Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Won't you first sit down, estimate the cost to see if you have enough money to complete it? For if you lay the foundation and you can't finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule you and say, 'This person began to build and wasn't able to finish.' Or suppose a king is about to go to war against another king. Won't he first sit down and consider whether he's able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000? If he's not able, he'll send a delegation while the others are still a long way off and ask for terms of peace. In the same way, those of you who do not give up everything you have cannot be my disciples. Salt is good. If it loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's fit neither for the soil nor for the manure heap. It's thrown out. Whoever has ears to hear, let them hear." The first thing we need to know is this. The Christian life costs. It costs. There's a saying about the National Health Service. You might have heard it. It's free at the point of delivery. Yeah? When you're in that bed, when you're admitted to hospital, there's nobody there who's demanding payment of you. A few weeks ago, a friend of mine was at work. He was on holiday. And while he was on holiday, he was climbing up one of these pontoons you see out at sea. And he was sort of jumping in, getting out, jumping in, diving about, what have you. And then he went round the other side and was getting back in. He decided to go down the ladder. What he didn't realise is that where the ladder actually went into the sea, it had rotted away. He put his foot on it and it got cut, quite a deep cut. When he went to the doctor on the island, the first thing the doctor said, he's coming in, you know, his foot's bleeding and everything else. He's got pressure on it, you know, trying to stop it bleeding. Came in, the doctor said to him, "How are you going to pay?" He says, "Well, I've got medical insurance." He says, "Go and get your documents." He says, "Well, I cut my foot, you know." He would not treat him. He had to go and get his documents. When he brought the documents back, it says, "You've got an excess here." I mean, all this time, this is sort of now 3/4 of an hour after he's originally turned up. It says here there's an excess of, I don't know, whatever, 200 euros or whatever. Where's the money? Back at the hotel. Go and get it. So at this point, the rest of the family had turned up, you know, and they went back and got him. It was only when this doctor had got the certificate, got the euros, that he would start the treatment. It says about our NHS, it's free at the point of delivery. But each one of you pay for the NHS. Yeah? It's taken out of tax and everything else, isn't it? doesn't come from nowhere. Redemption is free at the point of delivery. But Jesus says here, if you want to be my disciple, it's going to cost you everything. The time frame that we're looking at, Jesus had fed the 5,000, the 4,000. He'd done various miracles of healing. It's possible that he'd raised the son of the widow of Nain. Lazarus had not been raised from the dead yet. But that's the sort of situation they're in. He's actually on his final circuit round the area before he's heading to Jerusalem for the final time. His popularity at this point is high. The common people have seen what he's done, they've heard what he's said, and this is amazing. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, the scribes are starting to turn against him because he's upsetting them, he's not doing things their way. But the people are following him in hordes. He can't go anywhere without a crowd. Wherever he goes, they want to be. When they know he's in a particular place, they want to be there. If nothing, you know, they can get food, but if they've got problems, they can get healed. Demons are cast out. This guy is a miracle worker. He might even be who God has sent. So his popularity is high. The crowd is following him. He turns round to them and says, yeah, come on everybody, this is it, the biggest crowd we've had for years. No, he doesn't. Turns around and says, if you're going to follow me, you've got to do everything I say, and it's going to cost you everything. See, Jesus wasn't into a popularist movement. He doesn't want followers who are fair day followers. When the sun's bright, shining, wonderful, everything's hunky-dory, yeah, we'll go. Jesus wants people who will stick with him no matter what. So he lays it on the line. He doesn't want only emotion. Emotions are involved, yes, but he doesn't just want the emotional appeal. He wants people to follow him because they understand and know what it's going to cost and what it's all about. That's why he told the parable of building a tower. One king coming against another says, basically, sit down and think what you're doing. What are you letting yourself in for? I'll tell you, this is going to cost you everything. I want a settled decision. I want a mind made up. I want a knowing response. Nothing less will do. And as he goes through the things that he tells them there, he tells them first of all that there must be a priority. God must be over all. In verse 25 it says, if anyone comes after me and does not hate father, mother, wife, children, brothers, sisters, yes, even their own life, he cannot be my disciple. Loving and hating. It's the sort of idea of the Hebrew parallelism where you're contrasting one thing with another, light and dark, love and hate. What he's trying to do is set it into context. In John 12:25 it says this, anyone who loves their life will lose it, while anyone who hates their life will keep it for eternal life. He's not saying life is something repulsive, something that we ought to be revulsed by. He's not saying it's something that ought to be treated lightly or treated with loathing. Mortal life is valuable. It's given by God. But it has a ranking in priority. And it does not have supreme value. Families are very valuable and are to be treasured. But God is of greater value. Disciples must be prepared to put God above their own families. We have to look at self-surrender. It talks about the cross, the ultimate sign of self-surrender, the lack of control that someone who's crucified has. Puts value on life, but says we must be prepared to live life God's way rather than our own way. We have to be prepared to give it up for God. We have to weigh the cost. Jesus says you come into this with your eyes open. I don't want you having some sort of rose-tinted spectacle of what this is going to be like. Virtually every single one of the disciples ended up being martyred. They had to be prepared to put their lives on the line, because being a disciple could, and in many ways should, cost us everything. He also makes it clear in verse 28 to 32, there should be no turning back. Weigh the cost, understand the conditions, and go on from there. We have the situation in Numbers 14, where the Israelites have been brought to the land. They've sent in the spies. The spies have come back. Joshua and Caleb were among them. 10 of the spies said, "The people there, they're like giants. There's no chance. We haven't got a hope of taking that land." Joshua and Caleb said, "That's true, but with God's help, we can." The people believed the 10 spies and said, "What a waste of time. Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt?" They said, "We should choose a new leader and go back to Egypt. What a brilliant idea." No. God turns around to them and says, "Okay, if you say you can't go in and take the land, you're not going to go in and take the land, and your bodies are going to drop in this desert, because you're going to wander about in it 40 years until the children you said will be taken as plunder will take your place and go into that land." It says in Hebrews, it tells us in Corinthians that God was not pleased. I think that's putting it quite mildly. God wasn't pleased that they turned around and said, "You can't help us." So yeah, I think that's quite a restrained way of putting it. It says they were all baptized in the Moses. They all ate the same spiritual food. Nevertheless, God was not pleased with most of them. And their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. They chose not to enter, and they were guaranteed, as a result, that they were not going to enter. No turning back. The gospel is free, but it's certainly not cheap. And ultimately, it costs us everything. You know, when you tithe, what are you saying? I'm not criticizing the tithing of this church, by the way. The tithing in this church is fabulous. But what I want you to understand is what you're saying when you do tithe. You're giving a portion of what you have and effectively saying, "God, everything I have is yours." Are we prepared to give up everything? Are we saying, "God, you own the lot. Everything I have is yours, and I'm not turning back"? We need to make it plain to those who are coming to God too that it does cost. It's not just a case of God will bless you in a wonderful way and you'll be rich beyond your wildest dreams. Well, yes, you will be, but we're not talking about earthly wealth. The gospel is free. But Jesus says, if you will be my disciple, you've got to be prepared to lay down everything. It might seem like a raw deal, simply put like that. But in return, God offers us eternity. We need to know there is no blissful ignorance, but there is freedom in the facts and the truth and reality. And God is the ultimate reality that we can trust forevermore. Amen.